what I'm going to do is, it's a kind of map of the different positions available in this area, but I'm going to focus on what I take to be the dominant view, at least outside Oxford, namely representationalism and direct realism and sense-datum theory, and my own view, which is neither of those nor representationalism, are going to feature at the edges, and my main concern is to try and understand and discredit representationalism. So the issue, it's quite specific. It's what's the nature of the conscious properties we have when we have sense experience. So just reflect on your sense experience you're having now of me sitting here. Do we have any other slight buzzing from the projector and so on? So I'm going to be interested in the conscious properties that we have when we have sense experience. There's no doubt lots of other properties we have, lots of other processes going on when we have sense experience. I'm focusing on the conscious aspects. As it happens, I'm a physicalist, and I think that the conscious properties are one and the same, or at least grounded in physical properties, but that's scarcely going to feature at all in this talk. And I'm going to be interested in the metaphysics of these conscious properties, in their nature. So I'm not going to be interested in the epistemological implications of different theories of sense experience. Interesting topics, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about the metaphysics. Okay, so here's a nice simple view of what's going on when we have sensory experience, and I mean, this, I guess, is perhaps a dominant view in Oxford nowadays, that conscious sense experience is constituted by relations between the perceiving subject and ordinary physical, ordinary everyday objects like books and watches and their ordinary properties, like their shapes and their colours. So in front of you, there's a book, it's a right rectangular prism, it's kind of browny on top, and the direct realist view is that the nature of my conscious, the property I have when I consciously have sensory experience of that book is a relational property. It's a relation of seeing between me and that book and its shape and its colour. So the objects and their properties are constitutive elements in the conscious properties we have when we have sense experience. I'm just mentioning this as a foil for the view that I'm really interested in, the representationalist view. Just run through the obvious issues, the standard worry about this view. I mean, this view is very natural, commonsensical view. Seems to work very straightforwardly, captures what many people normally think, but the obvious problem, which is why it's not at the centre of the philosophical agenda always, is that it looks like we can be in just the same kind of conscious state even when there isn't a brown book in front of us. For instance, I might be under an illusion, it's a different colour than brown, or maybe I'm hallucinating, there's no book there at all. Couldn't I have just the same conscious property? And if that were so, then the direct realist account of the conscious properties I have when I have sense experience would be mistaken. I mean, contemporary direct realists don't roll over and die at this point. They go disjunctivist. They say, well, it's not the case that you could be in just the same conscious property in the bad cases. I've given you a good account of what's going on when there really is a brown book in front of you. And then these other funny cases when who knows what's going on, and we'll worry about that later. Well, we all know how it goes. I mean, is that gonna work? I mean, my worries about that are I have a number of worries about it. I mean, one is obvious immediate one. This is not an argument, it's just an observation that this view commits us to thinking that conscious properties are constituted in part by what's going on outside the skin of conscious perceivers, and that looks odd. And more serious worry about disjunctivism is, surely we do have conscious properties, or we do have some properties in the bad cases, and we want to give some account of what's going on there, and it's not clear how disjunctivists can give a positive account of what's going on in the bad cases without undermining the positive views. So, anyway, this is not my focus. I just wanted to get it on the table because I'll be mentioning it at various points later on. Sense datum theorists, just to get it on the table, another view that makes the properties we have when we have conscious experience relational properties, but now they're relations not to ordinary physical objects, but to philosophically introduced items, namely sense data and their properties. So, in addition, if it does, in addition to the book, if it does exist, there's a sense datum of the book, and it's my now bearing a different relation to that item and its shape and colour that constitutes my sensory experience. Sense datum theories have the advantage that they can introduce these philosophical items in the bad cases as well as good cases, and so respect the thought that you can have the same conscious property in all good and bad cases alike. But of course, the ontology of sense data is horrible cans of worms with sense datum theories. Where are they? How do they relate to the physical world? Where do they get their causal powers from, and so on? Okay. Given the difficulties facing both direct realism and sense datum theories, many, many contemporary philosophers are attracted to representationalism. And what I want to try and do today is show you what a mess this view is. And I mean, in a way, I can kind of form common force with disjunctivists here. I mean, disjunctivists don't like representationalism, and nor do I. And I think it's an interesting pincer movement that we can bash them from both sides. Still, at first sight, representationalism does seem as it might be attractive. So the idea is, well, we have a common factor across the good and bad cases. Let me switch the example from a brown book to a yellow lemon. Imagine there really is a yellow lemon there. The common factor now isn't some extra item that's present in the bad cases. It's just in all good and bad cases, we are representing there to be a yellow lemon there, whether or not there is. And the thought is that representing there to be a yellow lemon, it doesn't require that there actually be anything around lemon or sense datum that is yellow, any more than writing on the flip chart, there's a yellow lemon here, requires there to be anything around that actually is yellow. So you get the common factor without introducing funny data. That's the attraction. Now, there's a huge amount of contemporary literature on representationalism, and it's rather odd. There's representationalists that want to incorporate in their representationalism a naturalist account of representation. They want to think of representation as a cognitive scientist might, a relation between brain states or cognitive states and features of the environment, and then they want to use this kind of naturalist notion of representation to account for sensory experience and the conscious features of sensory experience. Then there's representationalists who come at this from the phenomenological end. They don't want to specially get involved with naturalist theories of representation. They think that the way to approach representation is via phenomenological reflection on the nature of our sensory experience, and they come at it from that end. And I think neither of these approaches get things right. My view that the naturalist way does fine on explaining how sense experience is representational, but it doesn't do very well with the conscious aspects. And the phenomenological way is fine, as you would expect, on the conscious aspects, but gets in a mess when trying to explain representation. And I think a lot of the contemporary currency for representationalism comes from flipping back and forth between the two approaches. Before I get onto these two approaches, let me say a bit about, just to get it really clear, what representationalism is. And if you aren't in this business, I don't know how many of you are, you might think, you know, of course representationalism is true. I used to think that. So David Chalmers and David Bourget did a survey about 3 or 4 years ago of what philosophers think about various things. Are you a physicalist about the mind? Are you a realist in morality? Are you an A or B series in time? What do you think about perception, right? And perception, direct realism, sense datum theories, representationalism. And in fact, I was about to give a talk on this topic about 4 years ago. Somehow I was fiddling social media, and it came up, look at the Chalmers survey. So I went to look to see what I thought, and I discovered that when it came to, I ticked representationalism. Of course, I'm a representationalist. Until I started working on this topic, I thought, well, obviously, you know, sensory experience is representational. It doesn't make me a representationalist. But the truth is, representationalism in this area of philosophy is a much stronger view than the view just that sensory experiences are representational. I think that sensory experiences are representational, but it doesn't make me a representationalist. Representationalism in the philosophy of perception is not just weak representationalism, but the stronger view that conscious sensory properties can be equated with representational properties. They're one and the same. Let me make the issue clear by taking an analogy of sentences in some language, English sentences. But think of the sentences not, as it were, constituted by their meanings, but just by the typographical arrangements of marks on paper. Or if they're spoken sentences, the acoustic arrangements of sounds. So those marks on paper, of course they're representational, their representations. Right. There's a yellow lemon on the blackboard. It has a truth condition that there'd be a yellow lemon nearby. But these items, these typographical items that are representations, aren't essentially representational. Just that item might have meant something different if the conventions of English had been different, or if a different language were in play, or they're just those marks might have meant nothing at all if we'd never made them sentences of any language. So those marks aren't essentially representational. They're only representational in virtue of the contingent fact that they are embedded in a certain social, conventional, linguistic environment. Just those marks could have meant something different. What they mean could have been meant by something. It's another set of marks. It's only a contingent connection between the shape of the marks and their representational properties. And I actually think my positive view, which will not be at the centre of this talk, but you may as well get it on the table, I think the same about sense experiences. I mean, I can be fairly literal here just to get the idea across. I mean, as I said, I think conscious properties are one and the same as physical properties. So I think our sense experiences are constituted by certain neural arrangements in our brain. Any being with those neural arrangements would feel just like me. Any being who feels like this will have those neural arrangements. And you can think of those as the vehicle properties, the properties like the marks, the shape of the marks on paper. Instead, cases which do, as it happens, represent that things are thus and so, the state I'm in when I'm looking at the book does represent that there's a book in front of me that's brown. But I take it to be only contingent. Just that brain state, giving me just those feelings. Could, if it was embodied in a different environment, in some being who lived in a world where that brain state registered infrared properties of surfaces, some other properties, that self-same state would have different representational properties but would still feel the same. So that's my positive view. This is the view that the conscious properties we have in sense experience are qualia. They're non-representational. Qualia often means non-functional either, which is not part of what they're non-representational. Ned Block sometimes talks about paint, mental paint. He has in mind something like a map in which different colours represent, I don't know, population levels or rainfall or something, and it's just contingent that that colour represents this property. So that's what I think about sense experience myself. I think I go further than Block or Peacock, who has some similar themes in his thinking, because I think that all the conscious properties that we have in sensory experience are only contingently connected to what they represent. And it's not clear that Peacock and Block go as far as that. Anyway, the focus today is on strong representationism. The other people who think, no, we can equate the conscious properties we have with the representational properties, the meaning properties. And I hope now I've made it clear what the view is. You're starting to think it is slightly an odd view. I don't know. I think it's especially odd if you start from the naturalist end, as a number of people defending representationalism about sensory experience do. Thinking especially of Michael Tye and Fred Dretske. They'll both feature later on. They think of representation in kind of naturalist, biological, ethological terms. Representation is something you get in organisms when they have brain states that stand proxy for certain features of the environment and guide their behavior accordingly. So you have these internal states that function to indicate certain features of the environment from the point of view of the animal that needs to orientate their behavior to those features of the environment. You have that kind of setup. I mean, there's various theories of a naturalist kind that try and develop this kind of approach. It's just the basic idea that representations is something you get when your brain state's being correlated with certain features of the environment, and that correlation's used by some organism. Causal theories, success semantics, tutor semantics, signaling theory all develop that basic idea. So mental representation is a matter of representing states being correlated with features of the environment historically and causally. So it's quite a promising program. You've got a naturalist theory of representation, and then the idea that sensory experience is representational, and you've kind of explained the conscious features of sensory experience in naturalistic terms. Work fine if it was plausible, but I'll just say, I just think it's very odd to think that how it feels for me when I've got a certain brain state, and these people are thinking in terms of internal brain states, constitutively essentially depends on what features of the environment those brain states are historically and causally correlated with. So the conscious feelings, I was about to say internal, intrinsic conscious feelings, but that would be begging the question, but just the conscious feelings are now being supposed to be constituted by a relation between some internal state and features of the environment. So, we're going to talk quite a lot about, you know, why people find this so attractive and plausible, but right, here's one possible explanation, and a pretty bad one if you think about it, but there was a time in the 80s and 90s when materialistically inclined philosophers of mind used to agonize about whether to equate conscious properties generally, pains, kind of experiences, whatever, with type identify them with brain states or identify them with variably realized functional states. And there was this big debate about whether you could functionalize everything. And then there was all inverted spectra arguments and Bloch and Shoemaker, and maybe colors couldn't be functionalized. And who knows? I mean, that debate somehow ran into the ground. And part of the reason I think that it did fade away was that people switched from identifying conscious sensory properties with type internal brain states or internal functional roles. They switched to identifying them with representational properties. And once you think that the conscious features of my sensory experience can be identified with representational properties, and we have this naturalist story about representation, you can start worrying about whether to be a role or a realizer physicalist. But if that's what happened historically, it does seem a bit odd that you're really worried about which things inside the brain are constituting your conscious feelings, and somebody says, oh, well, don't think of it like that at all. Think of the conscious feelings being constituted by relations between what's in the brain and what's outside the brain, and then you don't have to worry about the first question anymore. It seems to me a step backwards. You might notice that I'm not saying anything much here about broad contents and narrow contents. There's a huge literature on representationalist theories of perception that challenge representationalists by saying, look, there's good reason to suppose that representational contents are broad. And isn't that a problem? Okay, broadness here is the idea two beings who are internally, or let's say intrinsically, identical, can nevertheless be in corresponding cognitive states that represent different things. So, Oscar and Tosca, twin earth, water, Burge, arthritis, or just think of here's me and here's my doppelganger in Australia, and let's suppose we're physically identical and I'm in a brain state, which is a visual response to my wife coming in the room, and he's in a brain state, it's visual response. His wife coming in there, our wives look just the same, our brain states are just the same. My brain state represents my wife, and his brain state represents his wife. I mean, I'm not asking you to agree that these states do have such contents. That's the idea of broad contents. But the idea of broad contents obviously puts representationalism under some pressure, because if the conscious properties go to representational properties, representational properties differ across the intrinsic identicals, then the conscious properties are going to differ across intrinsic identicals, and that looks a bit odd. And those of you familiar with the literature will know that a lot of wriggling goes on. So the representationalists have two options. They can say, no, you don't want to read the representational contents of these states, at least the perceptual representational contents, as different in the two cases. I'm not really representing perceptually that it's my wife only representing perceptually as a woman of a certain appearance. So you can kind of try and insist that when you get to perceptual states, you don't get broad contents. Intrinsic identicals always have perceptual states with the same representational contents. Or, and you find representations making this move too, you can say, well, when push comes to shove, you are going to sometimes have to allow that intrinsic identicals can be in corresponding states with different contents, and so perhaps we should bite the bullet and allow that intrinsic identicals can be consciously different. And if you look at what Michael Tye says about Ned Block's inverted earth examples, or what he would say about a cosmic swamp brain in a vat, a being just like me who assembles an outer space in a nutrient bath for 20 minutes or so and its brain is just the same. Most of us, I take it, have the intuition that, well, maybe not, but many people have the intuition that that being would be consciously the same, but wouldn't be representing anything because its states weren't correlated with environment. And Tye says it's true its states wouldn't be representing anything and therefore it wouldn't be consciously the same. So he goes forward about the conscious properties. I'm inclined to put all that literature to one side. It seems to me to be fiddling about with the symptoms and not looking at the core issue. So it seems to me that even if perceptual content were always narrow, in the sense that, who knows why, but for some reason the cognitive states that constituted perceptions always had the same contents in intrinsic identicals, I think it would be still be odd to equate the conscious properties with the representational property of this state being correlated with certain features of the environment. It's perfectly possible to think of representation in the kind of naturalist, ethological, environmental, correlational way that I've indicated, and yet suppose for some reason that there weren't any broad contents, at least for perceptual states. And it seems to me that somebody who had that position would still be open to the objection, look, it just is peculiar to make conscious properties depend on relations to the environment. So naturalist representation looked at on its own just seems to me a very curious view. And in truth, the real motivation for representationalism about perceptive experience comes from elsewhere. It comes from phenomenological reflection on the nature of our sensory experience. So we introspect what it's like for us when we're having sensory experience, and somehow that's supposed to show us that sensory experience is representational. And I'll talk about that for the next 15 minutes or so, and then I'll be done. If you look at the naturalists, Michael Tye, Gilbert Harman, Alex Byrne, I mean, are they naturalists? Not so clear. Dretske. They all tend to argue on phenomenological grounds, rather than the kinds of considerations that I've been through so far. And not surprisingly, because as I suggested, if you just had a naturalist view of representation, came along and said, look, that's the right way to understand sensory experience, that would look very odd. This appeal to phenomenology in the literature now, the people who appeal to phenomenology in this way are distinguished. They're the people who form part of the phenomenal intentionality research program. There's an itty missing there. Phenomenal intentionality research. This is Uriah Kriegel's phrase. These are people who think that real representation is what's grounded in the structure of conscious experience. Maybe they also think, in fact, they're likely to think, if they think that cognitive representation, representation in belief and thought, is also grounded in the structure of conscious experience, and so likely to think that thought has a phenomenology. But put that to one side. They think that it's the structure of sensory experience that grounds the representationality of sensory experience, and all that stuff about correlations with the environment, that's something else again. Naturalists don't think like that. They think that the kind of representation you have within sensory experience is also the same thing that you get from those naturalist theories involving the environment. So they're different. The phenomenal intentionality people would think that a cosmic swamp brain representing just fine because it's got the structure of the consciousness and that's all you need for representation. But what the two camps share is the idea that you can reflect introspectively on the nature of your sensory experience and thereby ascertain that it's representational. Okay, how's that supposed to go? Let me try and simplify this by distinguishing between what I'll call C properties, which are the properties we have when we have sensory experience, and which are properties that we can know to be instantiated via introspection. So here I am looking at the yellow lemon, and I know that I'm having a certain property. Now, I don't have to, I'm not assuming that I know this property for certain. Introspection might not be infallible, but there's a sense in which I can know something's going on with me. I'm putting direct realism to one side for the moment. I can know something's going on with me, even though, with a far higher degree of assurance than that I can know that the lemon is yellow. I can know how it is with me consciously while being uncertain whether I'm hallucinating or having an illusion, whether there's a lemon there at all, and if there is, whether it's yellow. So there's properties that I know to be instantiated via introspection. Those are the C properties for conscious. And there's the O properties, squareness, ovalness, lemonness, and so on, that ordinary objects have. And if I'm going to introspect, presumably the C properties that I know to be instantiated by introspection, and figure out that they're representational, how's that going to work? It must be, it seems to me, that somehow the C properties contain, include, incorporate, involve, somehow the O properties. There's got to be some relation between the C properties and the O properties if introspection is going to show us that the C properties represent the O properties. What representationalists generally think is that introspection reveals the presence of O properties in sensory experience. They think that when we introspect our sensory experience, we can see that present in our experience are properties like rectangularity, brownness, maybe even lemonness, but let's just stick with kind of shape and color properties. And this thought is widely touted under the heading the transparency of experience. The idea is that when you introspect the nature of your experience, what you get are no kind of recognition that you're having certain experiential properties, certain kinds of mental paint, anything like that. All you get when you introspect are object properties like squareness and brownness. So here's two. Well, Harman was the first to go on about this back in 1990. The only features when you introspect your visual experience of the trees, imagine you're looking at a tree, you think, well, let me concentrate now on the properties of my sensory experience, and you, all he says that happens is you stare harder at the tree. All you do is attend more and more to the features of the tree. And Michael Tye, what I find so pleasing looking at the ocean was a certain shade and intensity of the colour blue. Not a property of experience, but a property of the ocean. Okay, that seems a kind of very natural, obvious idea. But it's not nearly as obvious as it seems, at least if you're a representationalist, not a direct realist disjunctivist. So, if you're a direct realist, it seems to me that this transparency observation makes plenty of sense, right? You introspect your experience, and what you get are the properties of the book in front of you. The real book is kind of squareness, it's brownness, right? And the direct realist says, well, and if you're introspecting a hallucination or even an illusion, well, then you'd be getting something else. Who knows what's going on in those cases? It's all a mess, those cases. The only case where we really get this transparent access to the objects themselves is when we're not hallucinating or suffering an illusion. But that's not what the representationalists can say. The representationalists are common factor theorists. The whole attraction of representationalism was it was going to give you a story about what's going on in the bad cases as well as the good case. So their story about transparency has to be rather different. It's got to apply to the cases where it's a red lemon and somehow I'm suffering an illusion it's yellow, or there's no lemon there at all. I've just been kind of injected with some drug and I'm having a hallucination as of a yellow lemon. And they want to say in those cases too, what property I know to be instantiated by introspection is the property yellowness that objects can have. And I find that idea very odd. Shall I? Well, it's one thing to say that my conscious current experience, that my world is lit up, as it were, by an actual instantiation of yellowness in front of me. But now go to the case where there's no yellowness in front of me, there's no yellowness anywhere around, yet in my consciousness there's yellowness, and the yellowness is supposed to be just the same kind of property that objects can have. How's my consciousness being lit up by it now? Where is the yellowness? Well, it's now an uninstantiated property. You might think of it as a platonic universal outside space and time. You might want to think of uninstantiated properties somehow differently, but however you think about it, it's kind of far away and not manifest in front of you. Yet nevertheless, somehow your mind is reaching out and grasping that an uninstantiated property, and that's what gives your experience the kind of technicolor phenomenology it now has. It hasn't escaped proponents of representationalism. This is what they're committed to. Here's Gretzky. In Hallucinating, we're aware of the properties, pink and rat-shaped, but we're not aware of any. We're aware of pure universals, uninstantiated properties. And here's Michael Tye. I'm happy to say that in the hallucinatory case, the perceiver is conscious of an uninstantiated property. This seems to me part of naive common sense. I can't resist telling a story. And I've been reading Ty Andritsky, and I said to Gabriel Siegel, who's my old colleague and had been a colleague of both of them, and I said, it's very strange what they say. So what you've got to understand is that Fred Dretsky has very odd intuitions, very odd intuitions indeed. And Michael Ty doesn't have any intuitions at all. So anyway, he thinks it's part of naive common sense that we are conscious of uninstantiated properties. So that's what they're thinking. Now, you can see how, if you thought what they thought, then you would think ish that introspection will show you that experience is representational. After all, introspection is showing you that experience involves, in some sense of involves, ordinary objectual properties, while leaving it open that the scene in front of you really instantiates those properties. And if that's what experience can be introspectively ascertained to be like, then I'm happy to say, well, introspection is showing us that experience is representation. I mean, introspection is showing us that experience is delivering us various objectual properties without guaranteeing that the objects themselves have those properties. And that seems to me to mean that experience, by its nature, would be raising the question, it would have accuracy conditions. Is the world itself, in fact, instantiating the properties that experience is presenting it in the statuate? But I find the premise here incredible. Can't make sense is too strong, but I can't see how somebody could seriously believe that that the conscious feeling I have now is constituted by my mind's being related to some uninstantiated property, probably outside space and time. If that's alternative, I'd rather be a paint person. So I just want to distinguish the C properties, the properties of me that I can, with a high degree of assurance, know to be instantiated by introspecting, from the properties that objects themselves can have. It's a kind of somewhat Kantian view. I mean, there's the realm of experience, and then there's the things in themselves, and the kinds of properties things in themselves have are very different from the kinds of properties that appear in the realm of experience. I mean, I don't think it follows from anything. I think that I can't know about the properties of things in experience, but they're radically distinct. The conscious properties, the properties in the realm of experience, do represent the world, but this is a contingent addition to their introspectable conscious nature. The kind of yellowness or ovalness that objects can have isn't the kind of property that can be present in my conscious experience. When I see something yellow, I'm seeing yellowly. I'm seeing, in the sense, I'm enjoying the conscious property that, as it happens, represents yellowness. By trying to understand what might drag you into the representationalist way of thinking, because it seems to me very strange. So here's a little initial diagnosis. Well, you start with the direct realist thought. In the good case, you're in contact with the properties of objects themselves. But then you're a common factors theorist, so you think, well, in the bad cases, I'm in contact with those properties too. And you don't worry too much about the fact that the idea that you're in contact with uninstantiated properties is very different from the idea of being in contact with instantiated properties. And indeed, you don't worry about the fact that, on your theory, you weren't in contact with instantiated properties in the first place, because all you're in contact with is uninstantiated properties in the good cases too. Okay, well, that's surely too quick, because look, I'm talking about very smart people here, and I've just accused them of making a kind of very dumb mistake. So let me try a little bit harder to understand what can push you into the representationist way of thinking. We typically refer to sensory experiences by reference to the objects. So we say she was seeing the yellow lemon. We do the same for thoughts. I mean, he was thinking about Barack Obama. And we use the same kind of terminology when the thoughts or the experiences don't actually refer to an object. So we might say she was seeing a yellow lemon when she was hallucinating. We might say somebody was thinking of Santa Claus, even though we know there's no Santa Claus. There's no Santa Claus. And it's natural in the cases where the items represented in thought or sensory experience don't exist to talk about the intentional objects of those mental states. Well, it's natural to talk about the intentional objects in both the good and bad cases, but in the good case, the intentional object is Barack Obama or the lemon you're actually seeing, and in the bad cases, the intentional object doesn't exist. Now, there are people who think we have to take these kinds of references to objects that don't exist seriously. Tim Crane recently has written a book defending a kind of Meinongianism about intentional objects. Graham Priest has been doing this for some time, and they have serious arguments. I mean, here's a construction we use. She was seeing a yellow lemon, she was seeing a pink elephant, he was thinking of Santa Claus. It looks like we're saying true things. The surface form of these statements seems to require some referent on the right-hand side, your left-hand side of the relation. And I have no strong feelings about this. I'm quite open to the idea that the best understanding of constructions like X was thinking of Y, X was seeing Y, should allow that sometimes the Y commits us to an object that actually doesn't exist, but we need to embrace it in order to explain what makes those claims true. I don't actually like this view, but I mean, it's a very serious view. I'm going to come on to phenomenology in a minute, but it's worth noting at this point that this view about intentional objects needn't have anything to do with phenomenology. That you could have this view about thoughts. He was thinking of Santa Claus, even though you thought that beliefs or thoughts didn't have any phenomenology. You might still think you need to introduce an item that doesn't exist, Santa Claus, in order to have the truth condition for the truth maker for the claim, the true claim that he was thinking of Santa Claus. So far, talk about intentional objects doesn't have anything to do with phenomenology, but it's, you can see why you might think, well, thoughts, perceptions relate you to an object, which might or might not exist. Okay? That's the first thought. Here's a second thought. So far independent, I'm going to put them together. Seems to me undeniable and important that even if you have the view that I do, that the world of experience is separate from the world of objects, has no essential connections with it, you should note that within the world of experience, there are certain invariances, constancies, over time invariant stimuli, corresponding to constancies in the right. So I'm thinking of this kind of thing. I mean, I move my head back and forth, and within the realm of my experience, there's some kind of item, namely the conscious properties I have relating to the book, that kind of stays still in my visual field. And what's more, the colour of the book stays still, even though the illumination that's hitting it varies because of colour constancy. So there's a kind of, within the realm of experience, structure that invites you to think of certain elements present within the realm of your experience as mind independent. i.e. as having a certain kind of independence of the particularities of your perspective, your visual conditions, and so on. Now, I think that what many people want to do is identify this constant feature of my visual experience with the intentional object of my experience as something that might or might not exist. So it's, here's somebody hallucinating a pink elephant. Suppose it's got this kind of constancy, it's a pretty good hallucination, right? So they're thinking, no, they're seeing a pink elephant, and the logicians, priest and crane, want to take that seriously, and in the case this really is a pink elephant there, then the real pink elephant is what they're seeing, and in the case where they're hallucinating, there's a non-existent entity, the pink elephant, that they're seeing. But if you equate now the real pink elephant, the non-existent pink elephant, with these features of your sensory world, and think that these things might or might not exist, then you get into a mess, I think. I mean, I think these things just do exist as sensory elements, and it's a confusion to suppose that they might exist as real pigs or not. But it's very tempting to think of these sensory elements as intentional objects that might or might not exist. But now we get in the mess, because now, when the thing in your sensory experience exists, it's a real pink elephant, and it's really pink, and you're going to say, well, pinkness is now present in your experience, because the thing that's in your experience really exists, and it's pink, right? But that same thing is just as much in your experience when you're hallucinating, and now it doesn't exist, but still it's got just the properties that the real object had, namely pinkness, so now it's got pinkness too. And now you've got the objectual properties inside your experience, which was the idea I found so mysterious. Okay, so that's a couple of thoughts, the intentional objects put together with the constancies in our experience, that would persuade you that there really are O properties in our experience over and above the rather crude thought I aired earlier. Here's two quotes making it clear that these are real properties possessed by merely intentional objects. Even its hallucination, it's a tree. It has the property of being a tree, even its hallucination. And here's Hogan and Tinson. Sensory states represent an apparent world full of apparent objects that apparently instantiate a wide range of properties and relations. But they aren't apparent properties and relations. They're real properties and relations. That's what they think. I'm going to stop now. This is just stuff about which of the various views are more commonsensical, but that's a funny game to play anyway, so I'll skip that.